This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The Women's Hoop Show, a podcast hosted by me, Jordan Robinson, brings you fresh women's basketball voices and breakdowns every week. I'll be joined by hoop experts all year long. Find the Women's Hoop Show on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Friday morning, April 4th, humid and windy and muggy and unseasonably warm, highs near 85 today, same for tomorrow, 55% chance for showers, then 90% chance for rain on Sunday, and then cools off by Monday, 65 for a high, then 70 Tuesday, 72 Wednesday, then warming through the weekend, but nothing but sunshine next week. Approaching 80, I would suggest you get out and enjoy the weather while you can, because it's going to be miserably hot and humid in the blink of an eye. One thing that's kind of fallen off the radar with the tariff talk is what happened with classified information and the Signal app and attack plans on the Houthi rebels and so forth. We didn't forget about it, though, so we wanted to talk to Dakota Rudisill, a law professor at the Ohio State University. He's previously advised senior leaders in all three branches of the federal government, including the Director of National Intelligence, DNI. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Great to be with you.
Thanks for taking the time with us. I really do appreciate it. I know for those that are listening right now that think President Trump walks on water and refused to admit that there was any fault or any wrongdoing with anything, this is not going to mean anything. But for those with open minds, we thought it'd be interesting to talk to you, since you have worked in the hallways before, been there, done that, as they say, to see just what kind of security indiscretion this is, if you want to call it that. Let's talk about a couple of things that maybe are not being talked about in this story that maybe should be.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, based on the reports, which have been significantly confirmed by the National Security Council and the Defense Department, meaning that the chat is actually what it appears to be, that those senior National Security Cabinet officials were on it. They were talking about the material, which you can read in black and white. So we know that. And I would say that at the very least, it is highly reckless for them to be using an unsecured commercial app to be communicating about military strike plans, and probably illegal as well under a number of different longstanding federal statutes. And I think there's some other pieces of this which have not really gotten much conversation, but I think that really should. Mm-hmm. So one of them is that this chat did not appear to include anybody from the military. And it did not include anybody who was doing legal review. When we look at National Security Council...
Let me just jump in for a second, Professor, if I may, for people that are going through their radio right now. When you say no members of the military, you're talking about no generals besides... nobody besides the Secretary of Defense, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Okay. So typically... decision-making at what's called the Principals Committee level at the National Security Council, and that's how they build this, right? Mm-hmm. This is the title of this Signal Chat group. When you've got NSC leadership at that level deliberating, you've got the people who are mentioned there, and you additionally have the senior military advisors. That's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you also have lawyers there as well. You've got usually the legal advisor to the National Security Council and or the Attorney General or somebody else from the Justice Department. And that's because when you've got the senior civilians deliberating, you want the statutory military advisor to the president, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff there, and you want legal review to make sure what you're doing is legal. And they were not here.
So what does that say about the operation or deliberate exclusion or inexperience? What would you infer from that?
Well, it's certainly a big break from how things have, you know, operated for, I don't know, more than a half century. And it's very worrisome. Congress should look into that, do its oversight role. And I'm glad to see that the Department of Defense Inspector General is looking into this. But it's a major break from how things have been done. And it's very worrisome because, yes, you definitely want the top civilian people to be conferring from various departments about a proposed, you know, use of lethal force. But you also want legal advice, because everything in America has to be legal. But the government does. And you also want independent military advice. And the law is very, very clear that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is the senior military advisor to the president and the National Security Council and the Secretary of Defense. And the chairman shall provide independent military advice, their own opinion on, you know, whether something is advisable. Then they have to execute legal orders, any legal order they have to execute. But it is under the law, the military has to provide independent legal advice. And so if the top civilians are not getting independent legal advice, independent military advice, I'd be very worried about the quality of their decisions.
News broke today. President Trump fired a National Security Council officials, a couple of them that I guess because they far right activists raised questions about him and staff loyalty to him. Does this speak to, I don't know if this is where you need people that, like, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. And let me explain it this way. In a private company, for example, if you replace one manager with another and the people behind underneath them are not loyal to the new manager, well, then maybe you need to make a change. However, when it comes to the federal government, when it comes to the Department of Defense or national security, maybe that experience is of the utmost importance, and maybe you need to tell the president the truth whether or not he wants to hear it. So we'll kind of discern the difference between those two when we come back. We're talking to Dakota Rudisill, law professor at The Ohio State University, previously advised senior leaders in all three branches of the federal government, including the director of national intelligence. And I'm trying to take the politics out of this and just talk about preserving, protecting, and defending the country and the Constitution of the United States. 621 traffic now, WWO. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWO. Quickly back to Dakota Rudisill, a law professor at The Ohio State University, previously advised senior branches, all three branches of the federal government, including the director of national intelligence. So, Professor, I asked you the question beforehand about some firings that happened with the NSC. How do you compare and contrast the security of the country, the infrastructure that is there when it comes to intelligence, with experience as opposed to loyalty to the new president or perceived loyalty to the new president? Because not everybody's going to agree with everything everybody says. Not everybody that works for the National Security Council is going to have voted for President Trump. However, you can't run them off just for that, right? Or how do you discern who's undermining you or not? You understand what I'm saying? How do you balance all that out?
Absolutely. It's an excellent question and an important one. So there are a few principles that are operating here. So the first is that the president, as chief executive, has the authority to have his team. That is longstanding and just makes complete sense. And you mentioned a corporation just before the break, mm-hmm. right? I mean, if it's government or a corporation or whatever, you want the chief executive to be able to have a team that person is comfortable with and believes is competent. Competence is enormously important here. And you mentioned loyalty. So a second principle here is that the way the United States government has operated is that that the loyalty is to the Constitution. That's the oath that you give when you're in government service. It's protect and defend the Constitution and the national interest, the national security. Right? You are executing legal orders from the president, right? The Secretary of Defense, whatever, right? But your ultimate loyalty is to the Constitution, the rule of law, and the general public interest, right? And so I've been very concerned, as a lot of people have, that there are lots of indications that this president prizes loyalty to him over the Constitution and the general public interest. And I'd say a third point is advisors to top people. So we were talking about the top military advisor to the president, which is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And then you have legal advisors, you have intelligence advisors. These reflect professions. And in these professions, this is something I write about, is they have ethical codes. And those ethical codes have a commonality in they have a heightened fidelity to the truth. And they also have an obligation to provide independent advice about what's the best military course of action, what's legal, what's not, and what does the intelligence say. And you absolutely need that because you need the senior most decision makers in the country to be operating with the best advice they can possibly get. And you need advisors who are willing to get in their face and say, Mr. President, Madam Secretary, Senator, whatever, right? You know, with respect, the way that you're describing things does not line up, right, with the military facts, with
and
the
Professor,
law, with the intel.
We're running out of time here, and I want you to come back because we never have enough time. But I don't think that's any different in a corporate setting. I don't think you want a man. You want somebody to tell you when you follow you know what, right? I mean, if you want to be successful.
Exactly.
So let's talk about the material as far as we know. Was it classified material? And as a result, are the necessary steps being taken to hold the people responsible if, in fact, they did inappropriately discuss classified material?
Yeah, well, so on the material that was in the signal chat, so the Secretary of Defense and the President now have both said that it wasn't classified.
Was not.
And I find that just not credible. Mm-hmm. When you look at that, exact times of F-18s taking off, when the bombs are going to fall, right? Like when the drones are going to, you know, this is stuff that is absolutely PS top secret classified when this stuff is generated. So I don't find that credible. Now, the President or the Secretary of Defense could have declassified that information before it was dropped into the signal chat. But note, right, in 2 weeks, have they said that? No, they have not tried to say
that. Well, that reminds me of the document thing, as you mentioned that, with the...
Yeah, absolutely. And there's been no accountability. President Trump ordered some sort of initial investigation into this, and then he decided he wasn't going to do anything about it. And I just find that, I find that stunning in contrast to something else we saw recently, which is all the evidence of how aggressive the Trump administration is being in enforcing law against people outside of the administration. Just one data point here. The Attorney General of the United States took the time herself to say they were going to seek a 20-year sentence for somebody who threw an explosive at a Tesla dealership as an act of domestic terrorism. 20-year sentence. And here you have the top national security cabinet who are talking about military strike plans and an unsecure app violating all sorts of statutes, and they're not doing anything. I think it's a massive double standard.
Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time. I hope you come back with us. Somebody texted in and said, I don't care who did it. It's wrong. I don't understand how people can blindly follow either the Republican or the Democratic Party. Wrong is wrong. The security of the country comes first. That's how I see it. 6:31, 29 till 7. We'll talk tariffs when we come back on WWL. 6:46, 14 till 7, Tommy Tucker, Friday morning, talking about, well, what else? Tariffs, because it's got everybody talking about it. It's got everybody in the nation worried and concerned, maybe the world, I don't know. Stephen Cates joins us now, Bankrate financial analyst. How you doing, sir?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Somebody texted in. Let's start with this, because I like to get the listeners involved at 504-260-1870. It's a tax if you, quote, choose to buy the tariffed products. I've not gotten that text before, so I thought I'd pass it along to you. Stephen, what do you think?
Well, I think it's going to be hard to avoid buying the tariff products. If you buy clothes, electronics, groceries, cars, any of the input products like rubber, parts, minerals, materials, all of those are going to be tariffed. I mean, we're taxing 60-plus countries, and they send us a lot of things.
So I saw Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana yesterday supporting tariffs and President Trump and saying, you know, toting the repeating the party line that is going to bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States. He said, if you want to support the country, buy something made in America. And that's easy to say, but I think he's smarter than that because he used to be the treasurer of the state. And I think maybe common sense or politics is getting in the way of this. And I said earlier, it's not business. It's not personal. It's just business. Tell me about where you see this whole tariff thing going.
Well, I think what seems to be at least part of the plan for the administration is that they want to certainly make a splash. They've done that. And they want some concessions. They want these other countries that we're trading with to provide us with, better standing in the world. Obviously, President Trump does not like having trade deficits with other countries. And he wants us to get concessions, whether that be less currency manipulation in the foreign currency markets, better trade deals, lower barriers when we export things to those countries. Whether we're going to get those is another story. We saw this morning that China has already retaliated with a 34% tariff on goods that we export to them. I think that that's probably not the last retaliatory tariff we're going to see. The EU is certainly thinking about one. That's going to be additional bad news, and it's certainly sending the market lower.
I remember years ago, and I'm going to try not to be too indelicate here, but overhearing an attorney talk to another during a negotiation and say, and this is a brilliant attorney, but he kind of went to the lowest common denominator and said, now, I tell you, if you want to go behind the barn and see who's got the biggest one, we can, but I'm going to tell you right now, you're going to lose. And I again, don't mean to be crude, but when it comes to that, that's kind of what's going on here, right? So who's got more chips, the United States, other countries? Who's in the position here to dictate what happens with tariffs?
Well, the U.S. certainly has a lot of cards to play. I mean, we are, in a lot of cases, the sort of buyer of last resort for a lot of products out there in the global marketplace. And one of the things that I think the administration is hoping for is that over time, we're going to be able to force some countries into better trade agreements with us. The problem in my mind is that time frame is indeterminate. That may happen. We may actually be able to accomplish this. And, I think some of the goals that the administration is hoping for may go in their direction if they can hang on long enough, because, voter sentiment, market sentiment are potentially going to move against them. And, that's the open question.
Say that again, Stephen.
So voter sentiment, market sentiment is moving against the administration. These changes may not happen today, tomorrow, next week. If they hang on with tariffs for a year or 2 years, maybe some countries, maybe many countries would start to sort of make the changes that the administration is seeking. But we just don't know what time frame that'll be over. And the American people are certainly going to be paying much higher prices on goods and services for the duration.
Boy, I think you just said a lot. Let me pick it up there when we come back, because you're talking about, that if it does work, and I got so many questions, will it bring manufacturing back to the United States? Because this goes back to a conversation I had 20 years ago with somebody about, you talk about currency manipulation and China and the Pacific Rim, and between that and the labor rates in the Pacific Rim, how it's going to be hard to ever get manufacturing back to the United States without it costing a lot more for the consumer because of the nature of the world economy. But that being said, if it does work, or if it could work, can the administration or can the reigning party survive if it takes a long time? Because they're saying, and it's about how the public perceives it, right? As if there's some pain, there will be gain, but you got to see some gain or else you get tired of the pain. Anybody that's been on a diet knows that. 6:51, 9 till 7, traffic now, WWL. All right, 6:56, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about tariffs with Stephen Gates, Bankrate financial analyst. Stephen, I'd like to get the audience involved. Somebody texted in and said, and this goes to the fact that tariffs were originally designed to generate revenue, not bring manufacturing back, but they said, what if the tariffs are the start of revenues for the federal government and the beginning of the end of the federal income tax, which would then put money back in your pockets? But what they're missing here is that they would be paying the tax just in the form of tariffs, not income tax. Accurate?
That is accurate. I mean, one way or another, people buying goods in the United States are going to be paying that difference, either through higher prices or through income taxes or payroll taxes or state sales taxes. You know, those are going to come from somewhere, and it's going to come from people on U.S. shores.
So my issue is, again, having this conversation about currency manipulation 20 years ago and a difference in what people are willing to work for in parts of the country, parts of the world, rather. And I asked the guy 20 years ago, the professor, well, how do we win that? And he said, we don't. I don't understand how you bring manufacturing back to the United States. You pay somebody what they would have to make, about $30 an hour, and that's not going to just make the cost of goods that everybody buys here skyrocket. Am I missing something? Can this work?
Well, so I think that if the goal is to bring manufacturing here, it can work, but it only works through higher prices. You
That's
can't have more
saying.
Manufacturing
yes.
here without prices rising.
Right. Because you're going to have to pay people more to make the products because it costs more to live here than it does in Vietnam or what have you, correct?
That's exactly right. So if the top goal is let's bring more manufacturing here, you can accomplish that. But you can't do it without prices also rising. Companies are only going to bring more factories here, or companies that are already here are going to expand production if they know that additional profits, additional revenue is going to come with that. And unfortunately, that means that prices would have to rise to incentivize a lot of these actions.
So if that happens, what happens with inflation?
It goes up. Wages would be going up. You know, we're in a very tight labor market right now, which we're going to find out more about that in the next few weeks as to how labor is going to be impacted through, you know, some of the most recent surveys. And that's going to impact all of this production. The tighter of a labor market we have, the higher you have to pay people to incentivize them to take some of these jobs. And as wages rise, inflation rises.
So
as product costs rise, the wages will have to go with it.
This seems like a dog chasing its tail. The only way this works is if the president gets concessions from other countries as far as tariffs on United States products, or?
So I think that, you know, ultimately, if they want concessions, which I believe that this is a negotiation, an ongoing one, you know, I don't think that there's any finality to this tariff announcement. I don't think that this is just going to sit permanently and that the administration has the intention to just sort of, you know, wipe their hands of the whole thing. I think that they want more engagement from other countries and hopefully can wrestle some concessions out of them in some fashion and, you know, declare victory.
Thank you, Stephen. I appreciate your time. Stephen Cates, Bankrate Financial Analyst. We'll talk to Jeff Palermo about LSU when we come back.